This is the Better Reading Podcast platform with stories behind the story, Jane's Be Better podcast, My Book Chat with Caroline Overington, and more. Looking for a particular podcast? Remember, you can always skip to it.
Hi everyone, I'm Jane Tara and I'm chatting to authors and experts about their self-help, wellness and personal development books. If you're looking for ways to be happy, be well and be inspired, you've come to the right place. Welcome to Better Reading Be. David Mickey is the internationally best-selling author of the Dalai Lama's Cat series, among many others. His books are published in over 30 languages and 50 countries. David was born and raised in Zimbabwe and then lived in London for 10 years before settling in Perth. He turned to meditation in his 30s to alleviate stress, and it was a journey that changed his life. Wanting to share what he was learning, he wrote his first books, Buddhism for Busy People and Hurry Up and Meditate, before turning to fiction. Today, he's here to talk about his latest book, The Claw of Attraction, best book title ever, I love it, and his experience with meditation. Welcome, David. I'm so happy that you're on the podcast talking about this with me.
Well, hi, Jane. Thank you very much for inviting me.
Well, I've decided recently that there's so much stress in the world and trauma in the world collectively at the moment. Individually, we're dealing with personal events, and then there's planetary events that are happening. And I got another meditation teacher on the other day to talk about this. I feel like the only thing that I can do at the moment is to provide people with information about what I think is one of the most important things that we can do personally and collectively, and that's to meditate. And I know that you and your work, you've made such an impact on this planet through your writing, through the written word. And so I'm just really grateful that you came on here today to talk to me about this.
Oh, thank you very much, Jane. That's very, very generous endorsement. I couldn't agree with you more in terms of the importance of meditation practice. You know, the fundamental fact is we can't change reality, but we can change the way we experience reality. Mm-hmm. And changing the way we experience reality is essentially at the heart of our meditation practice. We can meditate for all kinds of different reasons, coming in from different traditions and so forth, and there are a gazillion different kinds of meditation practices in themselves. But all of them, I feel, underpin this fundamental point that while we may not be able to change what's happening in the Middle East and in Ukraine and so forth, and what's happening economically in our own country, and what's going on in our personal lives, we can change the way it feels. And this is something that's widely recognized now by psychologists, especially cognitive behavior therapists. And this is why I think psychologists are increasingly prescribing is the word, prescribing meditation, because we all need it. Just as, you're not going to be your best self, physically speaking, if you sit on the sofa all day eating junk food. You know, you need to do certain things to get into optimal physical condition. And in exactly the same way, we're not going to be our best mental self if we don't train our minds. Mental training is fundamental. So, you know, you've got me on my favorite talking point here, talk about meditation.
But oh, same. Absolutely. I love it. And I think, so you came to it in your 30s to alleviate stress. And it's interesting that some people, you know, really do hit rock bottom and they turn to meditation, mindfulness techniques as a way of healing. But more and more now people are actually using it as a tool that they're incorporating in their lives for stress, which is fantastic. I love that. So talk to me about your journey in coming to meditation. How did you discover it? What was it like the first time for you?
Okay. Well, in a nutshell, I was working for a PR agency in London on Trafalgar Square. Wonderful job, wonderful clients, quite high-powered, certainly from my perspective, long days. And one day I found that I'd been bitten by an ant on my left ankle. I thought this was a bit odd, gave it a bit of a scratch, thought no more about it. And then the next day, the same ant seemed to have resurfaced and bit me on my other ankle, at which point I began to question the resilience of this little ant in the middle of Trafalgar Square offices. And that was me coming from Africa, projecting a cause onto what was actually happening, which was just the start of basically a stress-related or stress-triggered hives and itches and rashes. And they got worse and worse over the weeks until one day, I mean, my entire back was covered in hives, welts. It was very, very itchy and uncomfortable.
Damn, so, that ant.
Exactly. A whole nest of ants.
In the office.
Mm. After the doctor, I went and he said, oh, you know, you've got an allergic reaction. It could be to any number of things. Who knows? But I will prescribe you some antihistamine. You take one of these next time you feel a bit itchy and the itch will go. And so I did. And it did. It worked wonderfully. But after about 6 weeks of carrying around this little bottle of antihistamine pills, I thought, am I going to spend the rest of my life carrying around a bottle of pills and waiting to get itchy? It just doesn't seem to be a very sensible or intelligent or sustainable way to live. But anyway, a flyer arrived from a naturopath in my door one day. And amongst the list of things that she said she could deal with were allergies and intolerances. Now, I come from a very medical background. I've got my brother and my uncles and so forth, all doctors or surgeons or whatever, they tend to take a fairly, you know, down the nose view of any complementary practitioners. And so this has kind of affected the way I saw them too. But I'm a bit of a rebel as well. So I thought, well, what have I got to lose? Half an hour and £20 or whatever. So off I went to see this lady. Unlike the doctor, she actually went through everything that I ate or drank on a daily basis, suggested that I cut down on the coffee. I do have a caffeine intolerance, as it happens, but said, you know, Dave, the best thing you can do for your stress is to meditate. You are systemically stressed, and I suggest that you meditate. And it just so happened that I'd recently read a book called How to Meditate by Lawrence Lachan. It came out in the 1980s, and it was a very, very basic step-by-step guide. And so I decided for the very first time, I'd studied psychology at university, which perhaps made me more open to the idea that we can actually manage our minds. We don't just have to sit there and be victims. And so I sat and I counted my breaths in series of four. So exhale one, exhalation two, and try and remember to get to four, not lose your count, which is easily done, as you know, when you start out, and then just carry on in that sequence. And so that was my very first encounter with meditation, sitting in our little loft room, which is directly under the Heathrow air traffic bath. And so the jets used to rumble every 30 seconds, and my mind would go elsewhere. But bottom line is that was what I decided to do. And I thought, I'll give myself 6 weeks. And if after 6 weeks I have noticed a difference, I will continue. And if I haven't, then I can say, hand on heart, I gave it a go. Mm. And I actually found within 6 weeks it was working. And the reason I found was because my wife and I went away on a long weekend. I came back and I actually missed on my meditation sessions for a few days. Mm. And so I found steam coming out of my ears, you know, because, you know, whenever it's an act of self-discipline when you start to meditate, mm. it's not pleasant, it's not enjoyable, it's not zen-like, it's not, you know, you don't feel like the Dalai Lama after you finish, sadly. It takes a long time to get to that kind of state, but it's something you force yourself to do. And because I'd postponed and postponed it, what I actually discovered was that without realizing it, when you meditate, it's almost like you're building up a layer of insulation, emotional insulation, which helps you deal with all the crap that you're going to face on a daily basis. And if you slough off that by not meditating, it's like walking in the bush barefoot. I mean, why would you do such a thing? I often say, why do you go out into the world barefoot? You know, it's so painful. Don't do it. So actually, there's a sage called Shantideva in Buddhism. We love his work. Who said, I can't cover the world with leather to avoid stepping on thorns, but I can wear leather on the soles of my feet. So what he was getting to there, what I discovered is that, you know, by meditating, even if it's only for a period of 6 weeks, 10 minutes a day, that's all I did. Within 6 weeks, you'll start to notice your capacity to deal with crap mm-hmm. is greatly enhanced. That's one of the three, what I always say, three quick payoffs of meditation. One is that. The other is that you tend to find yourself becoming a little bit more creative and innovative. And that arises from the fact that there's less thought pollution. Because most of the time we are so agitated, there's so much stuff going through our minds. It's almost like this permanent haze concealing what's right in front of us. Allow that haze to a bit of quiet time, allows that haze to go away, to dissipate to some extent, we can start to see what we're actually dealing with, and things become kind of obvious to us. And that's where the creativity steps. And I've got so many stories I could share about this for me and other people. And the third kind of quite immediate payoff, by which I mean like 2 months, within 2 months you'll start to notice this, is that somehow life just becomes more richer and intense and gratifying. If you like coffee, the coffee is somehow more delicious. If you enjoy listening to a piece of music, the music is even more poignant and beautiful. It's just that, once again, it's the thought pollution going away. It's the ability to apprehend, to perceive what is right there, but without a whole lot of distraction and noise. Mm. And life just becomes so much more beautiful, so much more vivid and rich and intense and vibrant.
I agree with that. I feel like that comes from there's a contraction that happens if I don't meditate for a few days, and I can feel it around me, and I need to get back into my practice. So that release is there. There's a flow and a release. And as you say, you're right in life, and you know, you're tasting things and seeing things and experiencing things in a very, very different way to when you're not meditating.
Mm, absolutely.
So your path took you to Tibetan Buddhism, is that correct? Yeah.
Yeah, because when I was doing this and I discovered it worked for me, meditation worked for me. So, and just as a sort of a sidebar here, if there's any listeners who are not regular meditators and they've kind of always been sitting on the fence thinking, maybe I should, maybe I shouldn't, or maybe more likely they're relapsed meditators. They have done it in the past, but they fell off the wagon. I would urge them to take the 6-week challenge for themselves.
I agree. Yes.
Don't make a lifelong commitment. Make a commitment for 6 weeks. Say, right, whatever date this podcast is playing, I don't know when it is. 6 weeks after that, I'm going to reassess and see whether I feel any better. And if it's making some tangible impact, however modest, you know, because you don't expect to go to a gym and come out looking like Arnie within a week or 6 weeks even.
Well, I usually do, but yeah, you're right. Not quite Arnie, but you know, J-Lo at least, yeah.
And when training the mind, it's exactly the same. It takes time. You don't, you know, you've got to give it time. If anything, it's more difficult than training the body. So give it a reasonable amount of time. If you're seeing any progress, stick at it. And you'll want to stick at it because you'll enjoy the fruits that it brings. Don't worry about the fact that you can't sit there for half an hour and focus your mind on one thing without your mind straying. You know, that is actually a massive achievement, a massive accomplishment that takes years. So I would say set yourself a 6-week challenge. Now, the reason I got into Tibetan Buddhism was because when I was reading about meditation, the people who seemed to have many interesting answers on the subject were Tibetan Buddhists. And many of the meditation practices that we are familiar with in the West originated from Tibetan Buddhism. Tibetan Buddhism does not have a monopoly on meditation by any means. I mean, it's there in Christianity, it's in Hinduism, it's in many of the great traditions, but they seem to have a lot of answers, a lot of interesting perspectives on the subject, which is why when I had the opportunity to attend Buddhist teachings, I went, and that's when I really had a sense of homecoming. I thought, this is where it's all at.
And that's it, isn't it? It's a sense of homecoming. And sometimes I say to friends who have struggled with, you know, one particular style of meditation or another, you know, I say, explore a little bit, try some others, because meditation, even when it is the homecoming, when you feel like it's the right path for you, it's still hard work, but there is a sense of this is my space. And I want to be meditating in this particular style.
I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, I often say the word meditation is a bit like the word sport. You know, somebody who plays cricket on a day-to-day basis will do things that look very, very different from somebody who is a swimmer or somebody who's a boxing enthusiast.
Mm.
But they're all sports people. And it's exactly the same with meditation. Meditation is, there are so many different kinds, and it's different strokes for different folks. Some people like visualizing, and some people can't stand visualizing. They like breath-based meditation. Some people like mind-watching mind, which is a very subtle form of meditation. And so when you become a more experienced meditator, you can try all these different types out and get to grips with them. But when you're starting, I think it's really important to find something that you actually find quite pleasant, not too difficult. It's just like going to the gym. And if you have a gym instructor who is skillful, they won't force you to do those, use the machines that you really don't like using. They will find something that you actually don't mind too much and get muscle, build up your muscles with that. And then you go to those hard machines, because by then you'll be more robust and able to deal with them. Because there is value in many, many different practices. And you tend to find that experienced meditators don't just do one thing every day. They will have multiple different things. That's not to say we chop and change during the session, but we might choose to do different things, because they all, in a combined way, they really, if you like, flex different mental muscles.
I agree. And I do. I have a range of things that I choose from, but it all goes back to the same point. And we'll get to that a little bit further along, but it's really about opening the heart. And that's the center of my practice and of the claw of attraction. But I'll get to that in a minute. I want to talk about how you started writing. So your first couple of books were nonfiction, and that was to sort of share what you were learning, really. So talk to me about that and your stepping into publication.
Okay. Well, when I was learning about meditation, I used to enthusiastically chatter away to people about it, and they'd say, "Oh, is there a book that I can read?" And I never felt totally comfortable recommending this book or that book as an introduction to Buddhism, for various reasons. Sometimes it was cultural, like it was written from a very sort of US perspective, which may not be particularly kind of easy to get to grips with for somebody in Australia or Britain, or there may be other reasons. Maybe in some cases, the early lamas who came out from Tibet wrote them in Tibetan, they're translated into English not particularly well, and somehow came across very clunkily. And then culturally, they didn't make that translation for us Westerners, because we live in a different cultural world completely from Tibet. So I thought, arrogantly perhaps, I will write an introductory book which explains my enthusiasm to people. And that was called Buddhism for Busy People. And that was published back in 2004. So gosh, 20 years. And that did surprisingly well. And so my publisher encouraged me to write another book. So I wrote Hurry Up and Meditate, which is very much a secular guide for people who are interested in they just want to learn how to meditate and how does it work. Very kind of basic. And so that's still doing well, because people still want just no frills, just a thin, easily digestible guide on the basics. And so when I was promoting those books, I discovered that there are quite a lot of highly intelligent, well-read people, typically journalists, lawyers, accountants, so forth, who, when they go away on holiday or at the weekend, when they read stuff, they do not want to read more nonfiction, because their life revolves around consuming vast quantities of nonfiction reports and writing reports and et cetera, et cetera. They want to be taken out of themselves. They want to be lifted into a different place completely. And so because I'd always been a very keen storyteller, it seemed to me the perfect mix of being able to combine my passion and interest in the Dharma and Buddhism and meditation with storytelling. And so that gave rise to the concept of Dalai Lama's Cat series, and also Magician of Lhasa, two books.
Which best-selling series, and that's more of a thriller series, isn't it? Or an adventure sort of thriller series?
Yes, it's more in the thriller genre. Yeah.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely. So the Dalai Lama's Cat has been a phenomenal success. It's basically Buddhist and spiritual teachings weaved into the delightful tale of a cat who becomes the pet of the Dalai Lama. And I went on to Goodreads before this, and I'd read the Dalai Lama's Cat, and then, of course, I got the latest one, The Claw of Attraction. But I went on to Goodreads, and the love for this series, like, people really love this series. It's wonderful. And we spoke about this briefly just before we hit record. I have a novel coming out early next year that is a fiction story of a woman's journey to healing using meditation along the way. And what I love about this is that there are enough teachers out there But let's entertain people. Let's lift people out of their reality. They don't need to be learning as such, but in a wonderful fictional tale, in a novel, they can read it as a novel, or they can also learn the messages that are weaved into it. And you really have some very profound messages in here. So I'm just going to go back to the Dalai Lama's cat, the first one. And I love this quote: the thought manifests as the word manifests as the deed develops into habit, and habit hardens into character. So watch the thought and its ways with care, and let it spring from love born out of concern for all beings. As the shadow follows the body, as we think, so we become. That's everything there.
That is everything. And I can't claim any credit for any of those lines. they are attributed to Buddha, but they are in fact an amalgamation of things that he said in the Dhammapada. But yes, as we think, so we become is a very well-known Buddhist aphorism. And it basically points to the fact that reality, although we think that reality is coming from out there, and we are merely like a little rolling ball in one of those pinball machines that gets tossed and turned this way and that, buffeted by external events and what have you, the more accurate representations that we are projecting reality onto the outside world is coming from our mind. The way, it's not to say that things aren't going on out there and there aren't people and phenomena, but the way all those things exist actually is much more a projection of our minds than most people ever stop to think. Mm-hmm. And so that's good, because while we can't change a lot of the things going on out there, we can change our projection of them, which goes back to the previous point we're making. So basically, you know, it's reality is an inside job. Happiness is an inside job. We can get to the core of this, which is just as well, because we can't control politicians and the economy and people invading their next door neighbors and so forth.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
And by controlling how we react to it, we have an influence on people around us. You know, so there is a lot of research going into emergent consciousness at the moment. You know, we start with self, and that becomes, you know, we step into a much bigger whole. If there are enough people who are working on self, then that is the emergent consciousness that comes out of it. And I find that this is a really exciting time for that as well. But of course, the flip side of that is there's a lot of horror in the world as well. So talk to me about the cat. Where did the inspiration come from?
Well, I've always been a cat tragic. Which
same.
I don't dislike dogs. In fact, we're pup sitting at the moment, a beautiful little animal. I love all animals. I wanted to be a vet, actually, until I was 16. And I especially love African animals, elephants and giraffes and wildebeest and so forth. Having had a cat for some time and who I adored, a Himalayan cat, as it happened, I once heard that the Dalai Lama had a cat. And that got me thinking, you know, your creative process going, what an amazing life the Dalai Lama's cat would have, sitting on the windowsill, eavesdropping on all these conversations, the fascinating people he meets. You know, everyone wants to meet the Dalai Lama or spend a bit of time with him or, you know, touch the hem, as it were. So I thought, well, it would be kind of, wouldn't it be interesting to explore this? And so that's what gave rise to the whole idea of writing a book from the perspective of a cat, which is the most extraordinary conceit. But I thought I'll give it a go. And so I had a go at writing the first few chapters, and I wasn't happy with them, I knew there was something amiss. But anyway, I gave it to my wife to read. She's always my first reader, simply because if she doesn't like something, then I know it's absolutely crap. which isn't to say, she's the judge on all things, but she's like the first level of screenerator.
That's right.
She said, no, the cat is just too catty. And that was the problem. How do you, you can't have a nasty kind of cat who's bathed in the presence of benevolence and compassion 24/7. So I had to kind of readdress this. I put the manuscript in the bottom drawer metaphorically, didn't think about it for a while. And then it suddenly occurred to me, why didn't I write this as though it's my cat speaking? Because I had a very close relationship with little Wasik. She's no longer with us, sadly. But I had a keen idea, and I'm sure you do as well, and most cat lovers do. If your cat could speak, how would they speak? What would their tone of voice be? How would they manifest? You know, you probably have conversations with your cat.
I had my familiar, as I called her, my spirit animal was a cat called Luna. I have a dog now, and Luna died a few years ago, and I've never been able to go back and get another cat. I'm not quite ready yet, although I'm a cat person. But, oh, wow, the conversations that we had were incredible. So, and the wisdom of cats. This is why I love this series so much. So you heard your cat's voice.
So I just thought, why don't I try and write this? And this is a very going back to our previous conversation about meditation. I was sitting one Saturday morning, minding my own business on my meditation cushion, not trying to think about anything related to writing or creativity. And suddenly the thought just popped into my mind, write the Dalai Lama's cat as though it's Wasik speaking. And it's like, whoa, that's just like all the lights went on. And it's just so obvious. I mean, I knew exactly how Wasik would speak if she could speak. So I got up from that meditation session and I wrote the first two chapters just almost that weekend. That was the tone of voice. That is the Dalai Lama's cat is Wasik. It was just so easy and so obvious. And that's a very good example of how meditation can help make what would be blindingly obvious to other people. If they'd sat me down and said, right, David, can you think of any cats you know that might have a tone of voice that would be helpful? Well, it popped into my head. And so that was how the Dalai Lama's cat's tone of voice. Once I got that right, then that opened the door under the lock, if you like, and then allowed everything else. Because once you find that narrative voice, you've got to find something as a writer of fiction, as you know. You've got to find that entry point into your story. And once you have that, then it becomes possible for everything else to happen.
And so at what point when you were writing the first book, or was it after the first book came out and there was such a great reaction to it, at what point did you realize you had a full series in this?
Probably wasn't for some years, because it wasn't like an immediate runaway up the New York Times bestseller list type. It's never done that, never. But, you know, bestseller lists are kind of a bit... they're indicative, but they don't ever tell everything. A lot of books are done really, really well and sold far more books than ever get onto the bestseller list that have never been on the bestseller list, because they do so over a period of time very steadily rather than peak in a 1 week and get picked up. So that was more what happened with the Dalai Lama's cat. And it was sort of a gradual build-up. And I suppose it was probably about 3 years later, by which time numbers two and even three had been published, that we started to realize, gosh, you know, there seems to be a tide of interest in this. It appealed to different demographics. It seemed to have the right, just seemed to be the right for the times. There's no kind of rhyme or reason. Nobody can sit down and construct a bestseller. Publishers certainly have no idea what constitutes a bestseller. Otherwise, they would only ever commission them.
Absolutely.
And they will be the first to tell you that. So it's something of a mystery. And I read an interesting interview with that lady who wrote When the Crawdads Sing. And she was saying, it's a complete mystery to her and to her publisher that the fact that that book was massively successful. They never expected it. Who knows what resonates? But something seemed to resonate. And so I suppose it was a few years after writing that book.
And the latest one is number...
Six in the series.
That's amazing. And so The Claw of Attraction. Now, I love how the series has developed, and I've actually written down some of the names of it. It's just the book titles are so good. We've got things like The Dalai Lama's Cat and The Art of Purring, The Dalai Lama's Cat and The power of meow, the four paws of spiritual success. I love that title. I think that's great. Awaken the kitten within. Really, really great titles. The latest one is my favorite, The Claw of Attraction. And the book opens with a scene with a car pulling up at the Dalai Lama's residence with a bunch of Instagrammers, sort of young women.
Social media influencers.
Media influencers getting out, and they're all into that language, you know, of manifesting, and they run into the Dalai Lama there. And in a chance encounter with India's top 10 social influencers, the Dalai Lama is asked how to use the law of attraction to manifest abundance, which is the big thing now, right? He points out that material well-being was never the goal of such practices, as he begins to explain their true purpose. He says, when we see that all other sentient beings are truly just like us, that we all wish for happiness and we all want to avoid suffering, then our own love and compassion quite naturally arise. Sometimes when we open our hearts, the most remarkable surprises can occur. And while he's talking to them, the cat, I rubbed myself against his legs before taking my place in the middle of the circle of young women looking up at them. The Dalai Lama's cat, several gasped in amazement. She really exists. And that was like, that's in the opening of this. And I loved it. I love that you kind of set it up in this place, geographical place, with what is so prevalent now, this type of young person who lives for social media and they're wanting to manifest. And then you go in to explore some very big questions in this book about our power to manifest our reality. But it's not quite the way that, you know, so many current manifesting teachers would teach us. So talk to me a little bit about the inspiration for The Claw of Attraction and why you decided to write this book.
Well, I guess like you, I get somewhat frustrated. I'm projecting here. I get somewhat frustrated when I hear this law of attraction bandied about. And typically people want to attract money, wealth in some shape or form, stuff, material stuff or money, or it's love, romance, hunky boyfriend or sexy girlfriend or whatever, or it's some sort of achievement. And so these are three things that three of the top 10 social influencers, the Dalai meets, ask them, they want, like one wants far more, wants to hit a million on Instagram, million followers. The other one wants to a new diamante sunglasses from a particular fashion designer, which aren't out yet. And another one wants to attract love into her life. And so they all think, well, this is great. And the Dalai Lama actually points out the problem with all this approach is that you are essentially postponing your happiness. Mm-hmm. And this kind of shocks the women when he points this out to them. Because, you know, he said, why do you want to keep postponing your happiness? And they think he's, you know, they've got no idea what he's on about when he makes that point. And he says, well, if you're only going to be happy when you get your diamante sunglasses, when you attract love into your life, when you get your 10 millionth or your millionth follower on Instagram, then you're basically postponing your happiness until that point. And then based on our experience of reality up to this point, how long is the new diamante sunglasses going to give you happiness for until you realize actually there's a far nicer pair that had just been brought out by such and such? Or how long is your relationship with such and such going to be so ecstatically blissful that you don't start to think, actually, I didn't realize that he or she did X, Y, or Z, and this kind of changes the picture rather. Or, you know, the thing is we become dissatisfied with our things outside ourselves. There's actually nothing outside of us that is a permanent source of happiness. And so this goes to the kind of heart, if you like, of the Buddhist message, which is, what is the true cause of happiness? And the true cause of happiness is not to be found outside of us, even though we kind of go around chasing through life. And everyone around us, and certainly the advertising and marketing world, perpetuates this myth that by having certain things or configuring our life in a particular way or achieving certain things, we will be happy. But we know it's not. And anyone who sits down to analyze it can see the fallacy in this. But we still like little hamsters on a wheel because everyone else is doing it. We're chasing after things. But what Buddhism does is flip this on its head and say, well, actually, the true cause of happiness is inside you. It's your own mind. It's your own heart. The heart is not just some mushy, sentimental, indulgent type of concept. Our heart is seen in Buddhism as a seat of consciousness. Mm. And consciousness is both our intelligence, and it's also our emotions. And the two are part of the same whole. And by opening our heart, what we are saying essentially is that all beings are just like me. All beings wish to avoid suffering. All beings only wish for happiness. All beings value their lives more than anything. We'll cling on to life. We want to stay alive. You know, we can think of exceptional circumstances where that's not the case, but generally speaking, that's what it's about. And so when we recognize this, we start to realize actually there are some profound similarities between me and every other being. And what is so special about me that I should focus only on my own well-being to the detriment of others or not even thinking about others? And the paradox is that when we start to think about others' well-being, we ourselves are the first beneficiary. We become happy by making other people happy. And in fact, our experience of reality, which we've touched on many times already in this brief chat, which comes from our minds, is shaped by imprints on our minds. And those imprints are caused by the amount of benevolence that we, if you like, generate. If we go around generating benevolence, we will see the world as a beautiful place. Mm. If you go around generating hatred, hostility, polarity, divisiveness, etc., we will see the world as a divisive, hate-filled place. It's kind of obvious once it's pointed out. And so our prime job, if you like, is to cultivate our own loving kindness. And love is defined in Buddhism as the wish to give happiness to others. And compassion is defined as the wish to save others from suffering. So they're two sides of the same coin. So the more we cultivate those aspects of ourselves, the more richer and more beautiful and more benevolent and compassionate we become, and that's how we perceive our reality.
Mm-hmm. I agree completely. And I think my own experience has been, as my meditation practice has deepened and become heart-centered, it's really hard to describe when your heart opens up energetically like that. But it's a very expansive feeling and can be incredibly blissful as well. But when you have that, that becomes the focus. It's about being heart-centered rather than getting that thing or, you know, the person or, you know, the desire to have or to get rid of in your life. And yet, miraculously, things unfold more easily anyway. So when you're talking about the law of attraction or manifesting, to actually be sitting in that space and that being the purpose of your meditation practice, it actually happens anyway.
I would agree. And in fact, there are many places in the various Buddhist texts that I have looked at which shows that when you focus on the much, much bigger picture, these other things which you previously thought were big, were in fact are quite unimportant, fall into place in a more natural way.
Yes.
So it's actually about broadening your perspective and not being so clingy and grasping and all about me. And it's about stepping back, looking at reality in a far more panoramic way.
Mm. So David, with the series, is there another one coming?
Well, you know, you should never say no. I'm not actively working on another Dalai Lama's Cat book at this moment. Mm. I'm writing on another book, which is interestingly, one of the most popular characters in the Dalai Lama's Cat book is a yogi called Yogi Tarchin, otherwise known as Rinpoche. And in my new book that I'm writing, this is like a spin-out, if you like, but like Fraser Crane is a spin-out. I can't remember the previous series. This Yogi Tarchin has gone to Africa to visit his brother, and he finds himself in a place where, well, there's an elephant sanctuary. So it's basically called Africa Buddha, and that's what I'm working on right now. And I write on Substack, and I share stuff with them, and they seem to be resonating very well. So I'm really enjoying writing a book that not only is about Buddhism and the Dharma, but also is about Africa.
Mm, and I would advise people to check out your Substack, because you write about, you raise money for Africa, and also you do take groups of people on tours to Africa that includes meditation.
Mm. Well, every year we go on mindful safaris, we call them. And basically we meditate out in Africa, on the banks of the Zambezi River and out in the bush and out on the deck overlooking where the elephants come and drink. And we meditate. And It's just the most extraordinary thing. You know, there's more and more research is showing that being outside, being in nature, has much the same effect on us physically and psychologically as meditation. And it's no surprise, really, when you think about it, because basically the states of mind that are engendered when we're in nature, we're very present to the moment. We tend to let go of focusing on what's going on in our heads, and instead we focus on what's actually happening here and now. So there are many parallel advantages. So bring the two together, being in nature and meditating, and gosh, you got liftoff at this point.
Mm. I've just added that to my bucket list, David. That sounds really cool, actually.
Yeah, there are it's just fascinating the science that has evolved and be published only in the last 20 years about the impact of nature. You know, in South Korea and Japan, it's actually public health policy to get people out into forests, so-called forest bathing, because they know it'll reduce healthcare costs on the state. So they're doing it for purely economic reasons, not for anything touchy-feely at all. So the fact is that being in nature is good for us, both mentally and physically, and meditation is also wonderful. So combine the two in a magical place, we see wild animals and what could be nicer.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah, that's the My Safari. But yeah, the Substack, the thing that I write is weekly posts, and I share my work as I'm evolving. And I also, as you rightly say, people can either be free subscribers or they can become paying subscribers. And the funds that I raise, I donate about half of it to different charities, which are either Buddhist or animal related, because those are the two things that I feel. And I know the founders of all of them, so I know where the money goes, and it'll be well used and so forth. So those are the causes that kind of appeal to me in particular, and to the people that seem to like my work.
I love that, and I love your work. And anyone who is listening who would like to read your work, just Google David Mickey, certainly his latest, The Claw of Attraction, but all the books, go back. There's a whole, how many books have you written all up? There would be over 20 on your list.
No, actually, Claw of Attraction, I worked out the other day, is actually number 20. It's not like I sit there and I'm counting them, but that's just proud of either. I'd rather have written one book that everyone has read than 20 books that only a few people have read.
It looks like a lot of people have read them, you know, judging by the reviews I was reading. So, I'm so pleased that you came on to talk to me today. And anyone who is interested in, you know, learning more about meditation, please check out David's work. David Mickey, thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Jane. It's been great to speak to you.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
If you enjoyed this podcast, leave us a review and check out the other podcasts on the Better Reading Network.